Welcome back to Cover to Cover. I'm Joanne Joseph. Great to be with you again. Today we're taking a look at women's writing emanating from home and the island of Barbados. The experiences of women in these countries is so different in some ways, but in other ways we're grappling with many of the same difficulties caused by our socioeconomic reality, our histories, and the presence of toxic masculinity and gender-based violence which mark our societies. The first treatment we're looking at is by Cape Town-based poet, actress, and author Dr. Sindiwe Magona in her novel When the Village Sleeps. It tackles issues of loss of identity and dignity. She told me what inspired her novel.
It's a way of really showing or reminding everybody that life is not sectional. It's a continuous, flow. And it involves human beings, it involves the environment, it involves everything we know, including knowledge, expertise, feelings. We are all the same and we are all linked. And as families, the present generation can only learn from the preceding one, which also learned from the one that preceded it. Human beings come to the world innocent of everything. Knowledge, expertise, it doesn't matter what it is. We become human through socialization, through learning from the grown-ups around us, not only our biological parents, the entire village. In the case of children today, the village has become the world. The child who is born into a country such as ours is learning things South African, whether those are good or bad, whether that learning is intentional or accidental, it does not matter. Human beings gather as they grow. And that's what makes parenting so crucial to biological children, but by extension to all the children. The parenting generation has to be aware, cognizant of the fact that it is their responsibility to mind all the children. All the children in the village, not just your biological children, because whatever becomes of them, whether they make it into wholesome adulthood, has direct impact on your life.
Dr. Magona, you've done some really interesting things in terms of shaping and molding the women in this novel. I mean, on the one hand, they're very complex, they're flawed, they do make mistakes. They have become victims of their past, some of them, and the history of this country by extension. But on the whole, they are strong, they are stoic, they are survivalist, they continue to move forward all the time. Tell me about how you went about shaping this tribute to South Africa's women.
It's an amazing thing when you take the time to to look at a life, even what seems to be a hopelessly wounded life or damaged life, as we like to label people. Even in that life, there is a spark of something you could admire. It never stops to amaze me and pain me when I look at a criminal, the worst kind of criminal, and look at the ingenuity that person possessed to do this horrendous thing. And I think, oh my Lord, if we had only harnessed that ingenuity and guided it and nurtured it towards something wholesome, something that would have benefited all of us.
So, Dr. Magona, tell me, Tell me a little bit about this. I mean, on the one hand, you've created these really interesting characters and you've set them against a contemporary backdrop, but you've got the past intruding on that all the time, intruding in a pleasant way, though, in a useful way. You're marrying poetry and prose, you're marrying past and present, you're marrying history and present and throwing forward to the future. There are so many elements of that historicity as well as contemporary life. And you pull those threads together in very, very intriguing ways indeed. Tell me about combining those various aspects of past and present in this novel.
You see, I do not believe there's any disjuncture between now and then. We carry the past with us. It's been given to us. That's what we inherit from those who lived before us. And in my tradition, Africans believe in the ancestors. We do not think that when people pass on to the next stage of life, the spirit world, they disappear from our lives. Other people think it's memory. Others think it's, you know, the woundedness in us that we may not be aware of. Whatever it is, we have clans. The clan name, as we said of Tata Madiba. Madiba is his clan name. All the Madibas would claim a common ancestor. That means through all these people, whether you ever meet them or not, you acknowledge a relationship. Now we all know that life started in a single cell, one human being. We all are interrelated. And so traditionally, I am a Dolo. And, you know, when I was growing up, I couldn't have married another Dolo. You know, because even if I didn't know him before, as soon as, you know, in our introduction, there is always the clan name is included. Oh, siyazalana, we are related. You say that to a total stranger a minute before because of acknowledging that common, that ancestor that you all descended from. And so to marry the present, the future, and the past is to say life is interconnected and what we do now has repercussions or will impact the future. We better make sure we live a future worth inheriting. We owe that to our children and our children's children and theirs. We owe that to the future. We have inherited something from the past. We may not like it. We may not even be aware of it, but we need to really respect the past, our ancestors, and look with an open heart and an open mind and wide, vavid vakar eyes to see what it is in what they did that is worth fetching and knitting into today's life. We can't dismiss tradition, say it was, unless we are saying our forebears were fools. Whatever they did worked for them then. What is there that we can glean and use today? It doesn't have to be in that exact manner. Let's trace the core of it. How did it serve them? Ukuthombisa, the rites of passage for girls. I wish we could fetch that because it looked at human sexuality and said, how do we nurture this in the young in ways that will not have unpredictable, you know, fruit, that children will not beget children, which is where we are in South Africa today.
Dr. Magona, by extension, you are also in this novel, when you talk about the legacy we leave for our children, your focus is also much on the environment and how traditionally people have been tied to the earth on our continent, right, and in our country. So you get a sense of that sharp contrast that you create in this book with the bustling nature of township life versus the serenity of rural life and that notion of being rooted to the ground, working the ground, enjoying the yield of the earth and the soil. And tell me about what you wanted to say in terms of the environmental heritage that we leave for our children.
It also does something else that pains me, because there is the modern way, the way of the West, of safeguarding the environment. And if you look at that superficially, you would think that Africans, people in the villages, people in the township, have no clue. Because this is because that's another world that belongs to another world. You know, water from the tap is another world. It's a Western world. It makes it look as though the African does not care about the environment. And I look at tradition, and I looked at how the environment was worshipped, really. I talked about Intonjane just now. The budding woman, the girl become woman. You know, African women went and fetched wood from the forest. This was not a random act. When they were gathering those twigs, there were parts of the tree that were forbidden by the culture, where there was that little bud of things to come, you did not get that, you left. That's Intonjane, that little bud in the tree. That's what the Intonjane comes from, is the link between the budding woman and the bud in the tree of promising life, coming life, future life. There are an infinite number of things like that. You know, when people walked in the village, there was a saying of saying, tread, and then they would name the chief. Tread on so-and-so's land with respect, because the land belonged to the chief. The chief got his orders from the higher up, Ukamada. There were, you know, and one of our greatest poets, Unkai, says this, the entire civilization of Abantu rests on this respect for self, for the other, and for the environment, because the African always understood that her life, their life depended on the land and the air and the heavens and the rain. There was a direct link. Unfortunately, when the Western people came, we were taught, my people were taught, to believe that everything that was essentially them was barbaric, was backward, was nothing from your life was worth preserving. We left that life and an infinite number of things that could be useful today, including respect for the environment and how to safeguard it.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Dr. Sinibe Magona, who forces us to face some of the specters of our society head on in that novel. Now, internationally, women are often fighting the same ghosts, as I mentioned earlier, and this is brought home so beautifully, so poetically to the page in Cherie Jones's book, How the One-Armed Sister Sweeps Her House. It may be set in Barbados, but there are so many echoes in this novel that link the African diaspora in significant ways, not least the theme of generations of women trapped in poverty and violence, and the question of whether it's ever possible to break out of that cycle. That's one of the issues I tackled in my interview with Cherie Jones. Take a look.
In terms of Barbados and the setting, I think it was important for me to show all of, or more than one side of Barbados. I think so many people in the world know of Barbados as paradise, and they know about, you know, the pink sandy beaches and the beautiful sunshine year round and the crystal clear water. And all of that is true. That is Barbados. That is part of who we are. But it's kind of like, you know, we are so much more than just how beautiful we are. You know, like any other country in the world, we have our issues, we have complex social issues. And, you know, that was just relevant to the story that I was telling. For Lala's, for Lala and for Aiden, the beach that they live on is less of the paradise and more of just a setting for some very hard circumstances. So that was really important to me. And I think the beach was an excellent place to demonstrate the clash between the two perceptions of Barbados and the two different experiences that these groups of people have. It's the same setting, but it's a very different understanding of a place. So that was wonderful to explore.
And of course, you've done it so beautifully, and I think you've done it in a way that is actually going to connect with South African readers in particular, because we live in much the same circumstances. I mean, you've got beautiful areas in our country that draw tourists like a magnet. And on the other hand, you've got areas in which poverty, violence dominate. In which this affluence lives alongside the poverty, the violence, the disadvantage. But often those worlds actually do collide.
Yes. Yes. So, and I think that that's something that perhaps a lot of people around the world can identify with, especially if you are from a country that, you know, earns a lot from tourism or has a tradition of lots of people visiting from other parts of the world to experience that beauty and that sort of, you know, gorgeous setting. So yes, you know, I think it will resonate with readers across the world, and I'm happy that it will for readers in South Africa. And I think that's a side of certainly my Barbados that needs to be told.
You know, this is also an important feminist work, I believe. The stories of these women are so beautifully told. You know, the your protagonist, Lala, is exquisitely sketched. And the struggles of these women, no matter what generation they belong to, gives you a sense of that endless cycle of poverty that they can get caught up in. And that just never seems to leave them. They carry it around with them like a terrible odor. Tell me about how you thought about or came to this final depiction of your female characters.
Well, so for me, my characters tend to come to me more or less fully formed. So the character of Lala came to me first when I received this story, and we would have, you know, had a bit of a conversation on the bus. I know that sounds perhaps a little odd to people, but that's my creative process. And, you know, for me, this story was about the poverty in which Lala finds herself, the poor circumstances, the sort of financial issues. But it was more about the very restrictive parameters in which society allowed her to function as a woman, as a person. And I think when those two factors collided, you know, poverty along with these parameters that she perhaps doesn't quite fit into, I think that made for some very interesting work, very interesting conflict, very interesting as it relates to her story and how her story was told. So, you know, I found that the women came to me and that was the reality of the situation that they were in. And it was just a very rich set of circumstances to explore. I mean, certainly a lot of a lot of the circumstances that those characters struggle with exist in Barbados today. And I think it's just very interesting how, you know, through the generations, some of these struggles actually remain the same for women. So we may get more economically powerful, but we still experience certain restrictions in other areas. So, you know, even for Lala, for example, Lala is a hair braider. You know, in a lot of ways, we could say she has her own business. She's self-employed. But certainly the parameters in which she has to express herself are so restrictive that, you know, there isn't much of a progression from, say, Wilma's circumstances from her grandmother's time. So I think that was something that was very interesting to explore in the novel.
Yeah. And I mean, so are the male characters for all sorts of reasons. They are also beautifully sketched in a very detailed way. But what interests me is that they are simultaneously the perpetrators of violence and victims mm-hmm. of violence themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So for me, violence is a cycle. And I truly believe that, you know, a lot of those people who perpetrate violence have at some point in time been victims themselves. And I just think that's the reality of the situation. What I admire so much about the character Tone, who's my favorite character in the book, is that despite the violence that he himself, you know, he suffered, he still manages to be tender, to be considerate, to be resilient, and to be just an all-around gentleman, as far as I'm concerned, in a very difficult situation. So, and that's one of the reasons that I admire him so much. Some of the other characters, the other male characters, don't quite manage to overcome the violence that they themselves might have suffered at one point in time or another. But I have to say, though, that, you know, violence isn't just physical. And I think of the character of Grayson, who Lala runs to at one point, well, when she's running away from her husband on the beach. And Grayson provides her with care. He's a male. He's a retired medical professional, and he helps her. But when she says to him, you know, no, I don't want you to call the police, his response is very much in line with this, with a type of patriarchal approach. And he says, you know, I'll be damned if, you know, you don't call the police. Of course you're calling the police. So there is a level of violence in that. There is an exploration of, even, you know, though he is well-intentioned and well-meaning, and he actually gives tangible assistance to Lala, there is very much an understanding that even Grayson perhaps works out or demonstrates or manifests some of the problems that these characters in the novel struggle with.
Yeah. I want to ask you, Cherie, because you referred to Tone there and how he manages to overcome the difficulties of his circumstances in many ways to become mm-hmm. a better person. As we would consider it. Is there, without giving away the end of the book, is there a way to exit the cycle of poverty? And again, I ask as a South mm-hmm. African who mm-hmm. lives in a country where generations of people are trapped in this and just can mm-hmm. never find a way out. Is there hope mm-hmm. To break that cycle of poverty?
I think there is hope. And, you know, in the Caribbean, we have a tradition of being very hopeful and, you know, seeking opportunities elsewhere if that's what's required. So we do have large numbers of our population immigrating overseas, whether legally or illegally, and trying to earn a living and make better lives for themselves. I think it is possible. One of the ways that I think Barbados has successfully managed to try to stem that is through free education at tertiary level, for example. So education provides a way out. Of course, then there are issues with accessing that level of education. If you are from a poor background, that can impact your ability to learn and access to resources and so on. So by no means is this an easy problem. I think it's possible, but unfortunately for many people, it is still very much a struggle. So generally speaking, I think the two routes that people have tended to try to utilize to escape poverty in the Caribbean would be immigration and through education. But they are still large numbers of the population that remain trapped in that cycle. So it's possible. But unfortunately, I can't say that things are such that it is likely.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you a last question about how long this novel took to put together. And, right. And that's simply because when you read it, I mean, the best way to describe it is as a slow-baked novel. It seems like you spent years with these characters and finally decided after a time to put their stories on the page. Is my perception correct, Cherie?
It certainly is. This is a novel that was from start until finish, I would say just over 10 years. So it's been about 13 years since I started writing it. And it was about 10 years until the draft was finished. So yes, it was very much a long process for me. It was a difficult one. It was a case where I was putting the novel down, picking it back up and working on it some more, putting it down again. It was just a very difficult novel to write. But it was also a very empowering novel to write. And it was also a pleasure being able to have the creative choices that I had in writing the novel. But yes, it did take me a very long time, 10 years in the making.
And it shows. Thank you so much for your time, Cherie. Fantastic speaking to you today.
Thank you. Thank you, Joanne. It was really a pleasure to be here.
Those two novels are already on the shelf, so I'd really recommend that you snap them up if you haven't already. As if the choice is not hard enough, there are even more hitting the shelves in the next few weeks. Here's what to look out for.
I Am a Girl from Africa centers on the life of Elizabeth Nyamayaro, who would likely have died of starvation as a child in Zimbabwe had it not been for a bowl of warm porridge from a United Nations aid worker. This saved Elizabeth's life and gave rise to her purpose as a senior advisor at the UN many years later, fighting global inequalities and advancing social justice for the vulnerable. In the Dictionary of Lost Words, debut Australian writer Pip Williams explores the world of the Oxford English Dictionary's compilation and the story of a girl who steals a word out of the dictionary, opening her eyes to a society where words that describe the lives of women receive the least recognition. Investigative journalist Karen Dolly acquits herself well in To the Wolves, a real-life account of the origins of South Africa's underworld, what fuels it today, and the corruption that goes all the way to the top. It's an unsettling litany of the crimes allegedly committed by those we expect to solve them. The Black Pimpernel, Nelson Mandela on the Run, is Zuki Swawana's latest contribution to an intriguing piece of history. Aimed at younger readers, Wana details the 18 months during which Mandela was an outlaw, living under assumed identities in various disguises, so he could undergo military training to fight apartheid. Michelle Obama's much-loved Becoming has been reworked for the younger market. It's a personal account of her life story, her marriage to the former US president, her time as America's first lady, and her commitment to social justice causes. For primary school readers, Boitumelo Mutupi's The Girl with 21 Questions is an enchanting read for kids about a girl full of questions who struggles to get them answered. This sets her off on a quest to solve some of life's most curious puzzles. It's beautifully illustrated by Subi Bosa. Grab these and many more titles online or off the exclusive books shelves.
You can find all of those books at www.exclusivebooks.co.za or go in-store to get hold of them. Great having you with us as always. Eusebius McKaiser will join you for the next episode of Cover to Cover the week after next. For now, from me, take care. Bye-bye.